Do you need a realtor in Central Texas?
Of course you do. We all need a realtor in Central Texas. Even those of us who live in Dallas or Houston or San Francisco or Denver, Colorado, you need to go to Central Texas anyway. And the reason is Laura Baker is a fantastic realtor. She's great at what she does. She's a member of the elite Andy Allen team for Keller Williams. You can reach her at 512-784-0505. Talk with Laura if you're thinking about putting your house on the market. This is a great time to get market comps. If you're looking to buy in the market, you need all the help you can get. Call Laura, and it's 512-784-0505. Welcome to the Everyone Gets a Trophy podcast. I am your fearless host, Paul Wadlington, and I'm joined by a very special guest, a guy who I've been friends with for a really long time, and someone who, if you've been a part of the Longhorn community, you may have interacted with him from time to time. He's also prone to long periods of hibernation. He's a man that I call the alpaca, Scott Gerlach. You also know him as Longhorn Scott. He's got a very keen mind for Longhorn analysis. Also a really sharp, introspective, and thoughtful person in general. And Scott and I have a hilarious friendship, that the kind of friendship I have with too many of my friends. Unfortunately, I was bemoaning that with Scott, which is I'm not overly sentimental. I really value my friends. I value my family, but I do a terrible job of keeping up with my friends. And if you're a certain kind of male listening to this podcast, you could probably relate. And if you're a female listening to this podcast, it may be your boyfriend or husband, but you just don't always keep up with people. And then when you do pick up the phone and call them randomly or text them, this is me and Scott, we'll talk for 3.5 hours. And then both agree at the end of the conversation that we should do this more often. And then 6 months later, we ignore each other and then do it again. So Scott, with that long and overly verbose introduction, I wanted to say, welcome to the Everyone Gets a Trophy podcast.
Hey, Paul. Thanks for having me. Hey. It's weird to think we've been talking football for like 25 plus years now. It's bizarre. And yeah, I share the same thing, which is like, I sometimes struggle to stay in touch with people, but I think what's cool about sports, one of the things that's cool about it is it does keep people sort of picking each other's brains for long periods of their life. And I think probably a lot of men out there connect with like having connections to other people in their life through sports and talking sports over long periods of time. I've always liked talking football with you. You have this, like, I think really practical sense of football that you just instinctually connect with and can communicate. I think that's one of the reasons people love listening to your podcast. I tend to be very like theoretical in my approach to stuff. And so it's always cool to talk football with you because I feel like there's a balance there or like a mutual investigation that ends up happening. So I'm hoping we get to do some of that today.
Agreed. And you could see why I like Scott. He's one of my friends because he thinks highly of me. I think highly of people that think highly of me, folks. That's the key to it.
Or at least that they say it.
At least they say it. That's equal to me. It doesn't matter. The sincerity of it is unimportant. What matters is the props. Yeah, Scott and I do have a funny, we could both get theoretical, but sometimes I'll try to cut through it. You know, Scott's like, well, they could run this route and it would do this. And I'm like, yeah, also you could just have your safety stand there and knock the guy unconscious when he catches the ball. And then he's like, oh, that's a good point. So yeah, I think you got to leaven the theoretical and the practical, but without the theoretical, you wouldn't have the advances in football, which we have seen, the different offenses. And I think that's appropriate for this upcoming semifinal between the Texas Longhorns and Washington Huskies, because Kalen DeBoer and Steve Sarkisian have a lot more in common than not in terms of how they think about the game, in terms of how they scheme up their offense, in terms of how they use personnel to dictate matchups, coverages, in terms of, frankly, not having a lot of tendencies. And, you know, you want to have some tendencies. Tendencies are good. It means things you're good at, right? But Steve Sarkisian's not a real easy guy to game plan for, because he'll zig when you're thinking he's going to zag. And Kalen DeBoer, very similar. And the more I dug down on the Washington Huskies, particularly on offense, the more I saw the similarities in what they do in terms of how they attack a defense. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. And what we're going to try to do to maintain a little bit of podcast discipline, and this is with Scott's prompting, so I'm grateful for it. We're going to ask some questions, set sort of a context, and then we'll let the conversation go where it goes. Scott and I can be long-winded when we get together. I think we're terse probably in other aspects of our lives. I think probably our girlfriends and partners and stuff would really appreciate a little bit more of that verbosity at other times that we have with each other. But we're going to try to maintain some discipline, but the conversation is going to go where it goes. One thing I do want to make sure I talk about before engaging this conversation is our great sponsor. That is a guy named Gabe Winslow. You can reach him at 832-557-1095. Gabe is outstanding at what he does, over 20 years in the industry. He's been on all sides of it. He's got a law degree. But the most important thing about Gabe that's pretty cool is that everyone I've ever referred him to glows about the experience they had with him. And it just so happens, Scott, this is kind of a coincidence. I realized that as we got on. Scott, you've done business with Gabe.
Yeah, actually twice, in two different ways. I bought my house about 6 months before the pandemic hit. And in that time, I was like investigating different financing and seeing what the right options were for me. And you mentioned, hey, you should run this by my friend. And I connected with Gabe and he kind of looked at the financing I had available. And he's like, that's good financing. Do it. That's great. And then, of course, pandemic hits, rates go to all-time lows. And a little over a year later, he reached back out and said, hey, I don't know if you want to, but it's a great time to refinance. And we navigated that together, ended up with amazing rate that I will hold on to for the remainder of my payment. It's been, yeah, he's been very helpful with me, saved me a lot of money.
Nice. That's awesome, man. I appreciate that. And you didn't sound like you were reading off a script at all there, which is really impressive. What I wrote up, you really hit the high points. No, I'm just kidding. That was organic. It's kind of funny that Scott did do that. And look, I'm not going to hard sell y'all. The thing that I like about Gabe was the first part that Scott mentioned. Scott had already been down the process with another mortgage guy. Gabe looked it over for him just to be a cool guy and basically said, yeah, this is good. Instead of trying to undercut it and trying to poison the deal and get in, you know, angle in on himself. Gabe just sort of realized that the best thing he can do is be a good person, help out a fellow Longhorn and help out a friend of mine. And believe it or not, those chickens always come home to roost. And they did. They ended up doing business together. And I think Scott's satisfied. So anyway, there is the nice stuff that I've said about Gabe. More than he deserves, based on some of his recent betting recommendations to me that have been terrible. No, I'm just kidding. He's all right. All right, Scott, let's talk about this. And the first question, I'll begin framing it, and then let's dig in and talk about it. In the discussion, both regional and national, most people seem to have an explanation for why Washington's offense struggled some down the stretch. They were playing through a lot of injuries. I co-signed that. I've heard very little explanation for Texas's offensive surge in the last few games. What happened from your perspective?
Yeah, you know, we briefly discussed this at some point, but I think both of us have kind of been doing deep dives recently and kind of looking at the latter half of the season for both Washington and Texas. And, you know, what I hear about the last two games for Texas, where the offense, it really felt different in those games. What I often have kind of heard about that is, well, Sark was in his bag. That seems to be like the refrain. From my perspective, there was something significantly different about both the Tech game, and then it was even more pronounced in the Oklahoma State game. And that was like Texas's willingness to attack the flats with the passing game.
Hold on 1 second. You cut out just slightly. You said attack the flats.
Yeah, sorry. Texas's willingness to attack the flats. I think it's something we've done in the past, but if you go back, you know, I'd encourage anyone out there, there's some of those cut-ups on YouTube. You can go watch the games and just see every play. Go watch Tech and Oklahoma State and just watch the number of explosive plays that came out of Texas throwing to the flat.
Throwback screens popped in my head repeatedly, not just to the running backs, but to Jatavion Sanders, to wide receivers, all sorts of little waggle, like short routes, but with some initial deception. I think you're onto something. Beyond the play calls themselves, there's a volume aspect to that as well, right? Texas didn't come out with let's establish the run. Texas came out in those games with we're going to throw the ball and score a bunch of points, and then we're going to run as appropriate based on formation and their personnel, based on what we're doing to them and their adjustments. Is that a fair summation?
It is, and I think there's maybe even more to it, because it's not that Texas has never really tried to attack the flats early in games. But notably, Texas typically has done that in the past, primarily with quick screens to wide receivers, and then attempting to kind of block for easy yards. That was not as much how Texas attacked the flats in those last two games.
And if I can interject, if y'all will hearken back to some of the early games, we had an obligatory early play call of Xavier Worthy being thrown a flat pass, not even past the line of scrimmage, with no disguise, where Adonai Mitchell would whiff on his block, and we would instantly be second and 14.
Dan was like, burn that part of the playbook.
It went away. Thank God. Sark is capable of learning.
Minor note, like, I don't know that I can think of a wide receiver who has improved as much in blocking as Mitchell has in the course of the season.
It would be difficult to overstate the degree of shit I talked about him in postmortems on my podcast, which was well deserved, by the way. And then right around after midseason, I'm going to say, what was before TCU? What game was that?
I believe that was the Iowa State game.
Iowa State was after. Kansas State.
Yeah.
From Kansas State, or maybe even BYU on, Adonai Mitchell became the best blocker in the freaking receiving core.
Yep.
and the most willing and the most dogged, and the guy who's looking up guys downfield and just absolutely amazing. Proof that you can teach an old dog new tricks. So props to Adonai Mitchell. I like to credit myself, Scott. I think the coaches said, even this D-list internet celebrity notices your lack of effort, Adonai. Listen to what this guy's saying. So anyway, props to him. But back to your main point.
Well, so, Paul, I would even sort of – let me frame it another way, because in a sense, I'm interested to get your take on a theory that's developed for me about those last two games and what they might mean. So, you mentioned earlier Sark and DeBoer are the type of offensive coordinators and offensive, sort of play callers, which DeBoer doesn't call plays anymore, but it's still fundamentally it's his offense that he constructs. And what I like about both of them is you can connect the way they approach offense to sort of first principles, what they believe about football, right? And if you look at Sark, he believes in a couple things. One, he believes in stretching the defense vertically. Two, he wants to deliver the ball to players moving downfield. So he's using that vertical stretch.
Or just on the move in general.
Or on the move, yes. He wants to deliver the ball on the move. And then third, he wants to be physical. He wants to be a physical team. And the way that's manifested for him in the last few years, and even going back to Alabama, is he wants to pit sort of like your defense wanting to bring an extra guy to the box to shut down the power running game. But if you do, he's going to make you pay with the vertical passing game. And to some extent, he ran that same sort of look to the offense through Alabama. Was sort of the first time we really saw it come to fruition for Texas since he's been here. What I saw the last two games was a difference. One, we started to see a lot more of the offense being willing to work the hooks with like comeback routes, those underneath routes, which if we connect it to his first principles, don't really fit as much. So Stark has been reluctant to do that. But we saw it against Iowa State quite a bit. And then you sort of saw a progression from then of like, what else is he going to do off of that? Then in these last two games, you start to see us working the flats, hurting the defense a lot, and then also the running game opening up. And so my theory is that Jonathan Brooks getting injured actually in some ways made the Texas offense better over the latter half of the season. I know that's like a ridiculous statement. I think it's kind of tied to Sark realizing that he needed to go into a game plan, and Baxter was beat up too. He needed to find a way to use Keelan Robinson and Jaden Blue in a way that matched up well with defenses. And so what I think shifted is like in the last couple of games, what I see is Sark is attacking the other side of the box math. Instead of that question of, are you going to bring an extra defender against the run? Teams never do that against Texas. They're not willing to come out of high deep shells because of Mitchell and Worthy. They're like, the math never makes sense for us to come out of those deep shells. And so instead, what he did is pit sort of, well, if I take a player and bring them wide against the defense, I run them out of the box, how are you going to defend it? If I keep Worthy and Mitchell and run them right up against your cushions, I just like, they're firing out of the snap. So you can't read if it's not a quick screen necessarily. And you have to maintain your deep leverage. And now I have all of this space underneath to work, both in the field early in the play and to the boundary late in the play. So anyway, I know that's a long-winded theory, but like what I saw didn't seem like just game plans. Didn't seem like it was just to exploit Tech or Oklahoma State. I saw a shift in which part of the defense Sark is attacking and how he's creating plays for his players in space.
So I love this. And let me develop this before you react to what I say. So Jonathan Brooks being injured, forcing Sark to expand the offense, is correct, but not true. And here's what I mean by that. Back in ancient times, BC, I can't remember the BC time, there was an Egyptian, effectively philosopher, scientist, I don't know what you call them back then, before the principles of science have been invented, but his name's Ptolemy, right?
I think he's a Greek. Nerds.
He's a nerd. He was a nerd. You want to hang him up on a locker and just take his milk money. So Ptolemy was a Greek living in Egypt, I believe. And he was a brilliant astronomer. And the Ptolemaic system was devised based on his observations of observing astral bodies, right? Stars in motion. And, you know, it's very useful, particularly back then, still useful today, to know where things are going to be for orientation, for navigation, for seasonal predictions, all sorts of stuff, right? Also, there's religious aspects, right? So Ptolemy constructed a star map, effectively, where stuff's going to be, planets, all this stuff. In BC, that was absolutely correct, okay? You can use it today. However, for him to make it work, because he didn't know the structure of the universe, he didn't know the effect of gravity, he didn't know that, you know, all these different things, he has weird things in his charts where you have planets moving backwards at certain times and you have stars, but if you look at it and you make predictions off of it, it's always going to be there. It's exactly correct. And you could use it today and it actually holds up, the Ptolemaic system of astronomy. It took over a thousand years for Copernicus, Galileo, all those folks to upend it. And by the way, you didn't get much better predictive value out of the Copernican system. It's just that it was true. It was the actual way in which astral bodies move, in which planets are affected by gravity, the moon, et cetera, tides, all this stuff. So all this is a hoity-toity way of saying, I think what you're saying is correct, but not true, which is, I think this expansion would have happened anyway. And I think some of it had to do with the growth of Quinn Ewers. Also, it came in part with the growth of the offensive line. The Texas offensive line began the year struggling with the Rice Owls. Now, Rice's defensive line was a little better than the vintage of any Rice defensive line we've seen in the last 20 years, but it was Rice, okay? Right now, the Texas offensive line is one of the best five college pass-blocking offensive lines in the country. And I'll fight anyone who disagrees. And people say, well, Quinn Ewers got sacked three times. Quinn Ewers sacked himself three times, okay? You could watch it on film, and I'll show it to you, right? Yeah. This team has evolved and grown, and I don't think any team is static. So I looked at the Jonathan Brooks injury as Sark having to refine and rethink the offense. I think that we were headed that direction anyway. Because at the same time that was happening, we were already making changes. And then also you have some of the queering effects of the opponent. So let me give you an example. We played Kansas State with Malik Murphy. Kansas State decided to press us, double teaming Xavier Worthy and running press man on Adonai Mitchell out all by his lonesome. And we threw the ball, you know what? We had 350-yard completions in like a quarter.
Yeah.
That was a reflection of the opponent game plan. So that's also going to be a factor into this, right? Also, let's look at the opponents. Oklahoma State has a bad defense. And the way you beat that bad defense, as with any most bad defenses, is you make them run and you make them face superior athletes in space. So I think that was also a function of just game planning. Tech is interesting in that we put up a bunch of points, but as we tend to do, we've already forgotten a lot of those points were defensive field position, special teams, and defensive touchdowns, right? We actually struggled in the red zone in that game. It was kind of ugly early. And then we started busting big runs and big plays and things just got out of hand. Iowa State's interesting because it's almost a fulcrum point, Scott, in that we only scored 26 points, but that was on the players. Sark had that game dialed up, but we kept screwing up executionally. And so, you know, there's a default reaction. The coaches need to coach better. You know, no, actually that game is an example of the players screwing it up on offense. Texas still won the game comfortably by 10, but should have put up 42 points on the Cyclones based on the play call and the lack of execution of same. So those were absent Jonathan Brooks, but I don't think that those fundamental game plans, they were caused by Jonathan Brooks going out, but I think that's where we're headed anyway. Because of a lot of other factors, the growth and maturation of the offensive line, the trust level he had for them, Quinn Ewers' growth, which I think has been significant, the growth of the receivers, frankly. I mean, they're Xavier Worthy and Mitchell and Sanders are still learning their craft, right? The running backs all demonstrating their ability as pass catchers, right? That's another aspect of this. So I think that's a long-winded way of saying I agree with you, but I think it was going to happen anyway.
Yeah, to be clear, Brooks would have been just as dangerous in any of the sort of iterations that we've seen recently.
Yep.
If not more. But in a way, I think Brooks was making Stark's offense go early in the season in that sort of more traditional pit the power running game against the numbers. It was still functioning until he went away, and like Sark needed something. He needed to concede something about that, either by working the ball more underneath or by being willing to sort of work the ball in the flats.
Yep.
I think, I guess what the last thing I'll sort of mention is like, well, I agree with you about like, I do think this expansion of the offense, like, I don't think Sark just like, was like, oh, I wonder what'll happen if I throw to the flats. Like, I think he sees the possibilities there. But I think if you look at the Tech game and you rewatch it, I agree there were sort of some stop and starts. Most of our explosive plays, again, in that game came either from pressure we were applying to the flat or plays to the flat.
Agreed.
And I think that is what led him to making the Oklahoma State game plan in some ways.
That's interesting. So I think that's going to be relevant to Washington.
Yes.
So you guys hold on, because I don't know if you agree, Scott, but I watched Washington. I don't want to go off on a tangent here, but the tendency for a defense that doesn't perform is for people to call them soft. Washington's not soft.
Nope.
So, and I'll give you an example. There have been Texas defenses that I promise you the dudes on there are football players and they're tough and they're hard. They weren't fast or they weren't well coached. And so they'd give up points and people say they're soft. No, they're actually not soft. They're actually tough guys, right? And that would show up when they'd play a Nebraska, when they'd play a Utah in a bowl game, right? Utah is this rugged program. We bully everyone. And they ran into Texas and a Tom Herman coached Texas. And we freaking shook them down and took their lunch money, physically assaulted them, right? That's not soft. But you know why Texas defense was bleeding points and yards? Todd Orlando's bad schemes, bad coaching, right? So people use soft as a shorthand for bad defense. I don't. To me, soft means you're soft. You're scared of contact. You don't like violence. You'd rather pass rush than stop the run. You'll make a business decision as a defender. Big running backs bursting through unmolested, right? Washington is physical. They're not quick. And they lack speed.
And specifically, your ability to be not soft, your ability to be tough is a leverage question more than an attitude question.
Yeah. And I think Washington, so for example, if you watch their secondary, their safeties come up to support the run with abandon.
Yeah.
That said, their big safeties, when they did encounter rare elite speed, USC, some parts of Oregon, although Oregon sort of mismanaged their second game, they struggled. They struggled. They're the quicker players in space. And so a lot of attention is being paid rightfully to Washington's excellent wide receiver core. And I have the highest regard for those guys. They're ballers. Texas has three receivers on the field, and I'm counting Jatavion Sanders as one of those three, who are elite. And Washington has never seen athletes like that. And you can say, well, the Alamo Bowl, but no. Players get better.
There's a funny narrative that seems to pop up there where they're like, well, they contained Worthy last year. And it's like, Worthy dropped some balls.
Yeah.
But he was open all over that field last year.
I was sitting right on the bomb that he dropped with his broken hand, right? And I was sitting right there and he was wide ass open. And that was a touchdown. All he had to do was bring it in. So that's it. We've got a different Xavier Worthy this year. And for those of you who are worried, and I was worried, he's running around 100%. He's good. As is Jatavion Sanders, which is a big deal. We're going to talk about that later because I think Jatavion Sanders might catch 8 balls to this game.
The one thing I'll just add to what you said of like those three receivers being problems, and I agree. I think in some ways, it might be that extra layer of like a Keelan Robinson or Jaden Blue getting the ball against a linebacker who's in pursuit.
Yep.
Where they really get into trouble.
Agreed.
Because I think they'll have a good game plan for trying to stay in good leverage in their secondary coverage, but they may get into trouble in how they defend the front and then also defend those extra players in space.
Yeah. So getting back to our initial point, God, I'd give anything to put a healthy Jonathan Brooks on this team right now with the growth that they've exhibited, because Jonathan Brooks is considerably better than Cedric Baxter as our lead back in every phase. He can break tackles. He's elusive. Baxter, look, we'll see what happens as he builds out his body and his potential. And I know he's been playing through some injuries and stuff. He doesn't break tackles. And Washington will miss tackles. You can break you can elude them, whether you run through them or around them. And I think a big secret key to this game that no one's talking about is Jaden Blue and Keelan Robinson and rushing explosives. Because I think there's some potential for a well-blocked play for them to go for 60. Whereas a well-blocked play for Cedric Baxter goes for 9.
Yeah, what I will say for Baxter, just on that note,
Sure.
if you go to the tech, I think it was the tech game when Blue just housed that outside zone run. And it was out of a two back. And Baxter, in that two back set, he actually inserted as a blocker on the backside.
Yep.
And I do think he's fairly capable of like being effective as a blocker in that two back, which is adds an interesting additional problem to deal with from those two back sets. But I agree with you, especially in terms of just reading blocking and being patient for the whole, Baxter has struggled.
Agreed. Well, whatever happens with Jonathan Brooks, I think he's going to go, whether he comes back to Texas or he decides to go in the NFL and earn his way into that much coveted second contract that all NFL players dream about. I know a guy he needs to call, and that's a guy named David McClellan. David is a former multi-national championship swimmer at the University of Texas. He's also a partner with Forum Financial Management, a fiduciary, registered investment advisor. Not your typical advisor. He is a subject matter expert. This is my opinion, not David's, but most financial advisors are salespeople. Some financial advisors have deep industry experience and real world knowledge about the market, about how things work, and how you can optimize your finances. In fact, David has written white papers on retirement planning. He has written multi-part original Kiplinger articles and series about the tax bomb and your retirement IRA. And he is someone that other financial planners, frankly, consult. That's the guy I like to go to. The people in the industry who look to him for answers. I don't look to the guys who are looking to him for answers. So if you want to optimize your financial world, whether you're in the process of building wealth or you've got wealth now and you want to maximize and secure it, give him a call, 312-933-8823, 312-933-8823. Sadly, Scott does not have a personal testimonial for Mr. McClellan as he did for Gabe, but I can tell you the folks that work with David really appreciate his knowledge, his sophistication, and the fact that he has a heart of a teacher. He's not a guy that's just going to tell you what to do. He's a guy who's going to talk to through your options, give you ownership, and also explain why he has some of the recommendations that he does. So in that vein, Scott, can I go to our next question?
Let's do it.
For each team, in what ways did their schedule prepare them well for this game? And in what ways do we think it didn't prepare them for this game? And I have one initial thought, if you'll allow it.
Go for it.
Okay. I think Washington is about as battle-hardened a team in terms of experience, in terms of playing different environments, playing in different games, playing in different ebbs and flows. Washington's won games in the 20s. Washington's won wild shootouts. Washington's blown teams out. Washington's trailed Oregon, you know, by a touchdown, and then rallied back to win. This is a deeply experienced, really old team. These guys are working on their freaking doctorates by now, some of these guys. Most of these core guys for Washington, they're freaking Chris Peterson recruits, Scott. Doesn't that feel like a long time ago?
It's wild.
Yeah, that's the core and infrastructure of this team. Chris Peterson, 21 holdovers, 11 of those 21 to earn all-PAC honors. That's the infrastructure of this team. Kalen DeBoer provided the quarterback and the offensive genius. So interesting. But
interesting to see if the talent evaluation sort of holds up over time, because Peterson.
I made exactly that point in my Inside Texas article, which is the chassis of this team was provided by Peterson. The finishes, the styling, beautiful finishes are all Kalen DeBoer. The idea, I think Kalen DeBoer is a genius, and I think his in-game management is the best I've seen in college football this year. I think he makes brilliant decisions in-game, in context. And I love his demeanor on the sideline, just a rock. That said, I don't think he's a proven program builder at this level at Washington. So we'll see. But Peterson is the guy, and I love Chris Peterson. So
just random like sort of thought just in response to that.
Yes, sir.
I think when Sark came to Texas, I thought what we were getting would be the play caller and the game day coach, and I had questions about program building.
Yeah.
And ironically, it's been the programming building aspect and culture building aspect of his time here so far that have been what carried him.
Yeah, we've got the culture, we've got the program building, we've got certainly the play calling. In-game management, I'm going to give Sark about a C plus. no disrespect.
It's ups and downs there for sure.
It's hard to call plays and manage a game at the same time.
So you were mentioning that Washington's very battle hardened.
Yes, but here's what Washington did not have to prepare them for this game. They never faced an elite defensive line. And I know some of y'all are saying Oregon right now. No. Oregon is a far cry in terms of strength, size, and general violence compared to our defensive line, Anthony Hill, Jalen Ford. It's a whole nother level, dog, to quote the great Vince Young. So y'all just trust me on that one. And then secondly, there was one really good defensive line in the pack this year, UCLA. Now that's about all they had, but Washington didn't face them. And the reason I bring that up is because we think Washington has an elite pass protecting offensive line, just like Texas. But we also don't know how they'll respond to waves and waves of really high-end defensive linemen coming at them. And in particular, the Pac-12 does not have good defensive tackles. Okay? I mean, forget Byron Murphy and Tavondre Sweat. They're the two best in the country. Vernon Broughton and Alfred Collins would be a really big deal in the Pac-12. They would be a starting duo for every team in the league. So understand that this is going to be a four-quarter game. And part of Washington's ability to never allow an opponent to separate from them is, one, because they're so veteran, they're so experienced, and they're calm, they're sort of unflappable. But two, they don't have waves of pass rushers coming at them for four quarters. And Texas, in the Alamo Bowl, and I know it seems like it was very recent, We are, no man goes to the same river twice. He's not the same man, and it's not the same river. That's Texas. Every single player that was on the Texas defensive line leveled up or got replaced and improved. And that's Tavondre Sweat, Byron Murphy, Alfred Collins, Vernon Broughton. Ethan Burke is better than what we trotted out there. Even Baron Sorrell is better than Baron Sorrell from 9 months ago or 10 months ago. So, or a year ago. What am I doing? Anyway, I think that's an interesting aspect to this game because that's a confounding variable to play action, particularly. There's a perception, two perceptions that I think the average fan has that are not correct. One, Washington plays fast. No, they're deliberate and fairly slow on offense. Two, that Washington is a crazy drop back passing team. They are a play action passing team. Now, can they drop back and throw the ball? Yeah, they got an NFL quarterback and three NFL receivers and a good offensive line. However, Michael Penix has thrown 9 interceptions this year, Scott. Do you know how many of those came on play action?
I'm going to go with 0.
0. When Kalen DeBoer is in his bag in very Sark-like fashion and gets the alignments and the coverages that he wants from a run-friendly sort of alignment on offense, that's when he play actions. That's when Penix throws these YOLO deep balls falling backwards on to Jalen McMillan, who runs a freaking drag from starting on one end of the field all the way across to the other end of the field on play action. And that's where Michael Penix and Washington are at their most deadly. What if you have two defensive tackles that allow you to play an honest or even light box and you just shrug at their play action and say, we're good. We're going to have our linebackers just dropping back into coverage, or we're going to have our secondary effectively just playing pass. We're not super concerned with Dylan Johnson. That's a confounding variable that I don't think that their season schedule has prepared them for. Now, what about Texas? What has our schedule prepared us for? And what has it not prepared us for against Washington?
I want to go back and sort of highlight or expand on a few things you said that I
Sure.
think are really interesting. One, I completely agree about sort of the matchup with the defensive, with Texas's defensive line. I think that's a thing that Washington's schedule it has not prepared them for. And it's also, I think there's a question, a fundamental question of like how they approach that game plan with the tools that they normally use. Kind of to build on your, you know, talking about how their offensive line works. I think it frustrates defensive lines and particularly Pac-12 defensive lines, which are, as you sort of mentioned, what you have is a lot of sort of pluggers in the middle in that league who are big, can be hard to move, but also they have a hard time moving. And then
it's a 6'1", 315-pound Polynesian guy.
Yeah.
About 7 times out of 10. And the guy's physical, he's tough, he's rugged, but he's not a pass rusher, and he's not making explosive plays sideline to sideline like Byron Murphy.
And so I think Washington is fundamentally, they're an outside zone team that complements that with sort of plays off of it. And that pairs really well with their protection and their rollout passing. And so, yeah, I have a similar sort of question about like what happens if, because I think there's two things about Texas's defensive front that have the potential to be something that Washington just has not dealt with. One of them is the ability to have big athletic guys who can legitimately shut down B gap to B gap inside
yes.
without help. And that creates a real problem in terms of when you think about a lot of what they do is based on opening gaps inside by either letting penetration happen and running behind it or spreading out the defensive line and then finding seams. So I think one, that's a big problem for them. Then two, I don't know if they've ever faced the type of size we can bring to the edge position and power we can bring to the edge position. So
yes.
The Pac-12 tends to have more of the traditional like pass rushing defensive ends. And they've made a lot of plays, specifically Oregon. They had a lot of success with being able to run that sort of like two puller scheme and kick out those ends and create creases. They're not going to be able to do that against Texas's front. So I think a question I have in my head about, you know, have they prepared well, what about their schedule prepared them for this is like, what happens if Texas's front kind of employs a similar game plan that it did against Baylor, where they came out and took big guys on the edges and just smashed against that sort of outside zone movement and basically said, we are going to compact you like a slinky. And what happens if Washington can't move the pocket like they want to? So anyway, I think that's a really interesting question. I don't have an answer. And I also don't know how Washington will attempt to cope with it.
I love that thought. And I think there's, look, I certainly appreciate every player that plays for Texas. They're out there giving their all. I don't really want to see a lot of Justice Finkley in this game.
Agreed.
I want to see
respect for, you know, he uses his body when he's out there for all he's got. And
yeah.
And I have respect for him, like the way he plays the game. But yes, I think we want different matchups.
Washington's tackles are 6'8", 6'6", long armed. They will literally big brother him. And they can't do that to Ethan Burke, Alfred Collins, and Baron Sorrell in a rotation, play after play after play. And Alfred Collins, he'll put those tackles on skates
yep.
when he's feeling it. And that is really where Penix has a massive drop off. So people will sort of ask, hey, you know, Penix is awesome in college. He makes these great throws. He's accurate. He's tough as hell, plays through injuries. I don't know his IQ. I know his football IQ looks pretty good, right? Why isn't he like a top 5 NFL draft pick? Like, I mean, you know, why is Drake May and Caleb Williams? Everyone's conceding them, and Jaden Daniels is the dark rising star. And the answer is, when people get into his mix and really get in him in a dirty pocket, everything falls apart for him when he can't retreat.
Yeah,
because
I mean,
he's not a scrambling quarterback. He's a retreating quarterback, right?
He doesn't operate well in the pocket.
Yeah.
He wants space from the pocket so he can feel pressure.
Yes.
And have enough time to get the ball away. And then also he wants to roll out where he can see the whole field.
Yep.
I'd also say when he is in the pocket, he's actually fairly susceptible to batted passes.
Yeah. He has a little windup in his release. Yeah, he's got a little windup in his release that you can actually make a play on the ball. If you can dirty that pocket and get in there, you can knock into his arm, or you can grab the ball out of his hand. You know, that's the hope. So, you know, that's the hope for Anthony Hill screaming on an interior blitz. Once the big guys beat them up and they start having to double and roll protections, you want Anthony Hill or Jalen Ford or even David Benda, because he's, you know, David's quick as hell in short spaces. You want them taking that slight pause for them to declare the blocking, and then steams in behind Byron Murphy and gets that big play strip or something like that, which against a Washington, look, in any game, stripping the quarterback is a big deal. And against Washington, it's like everything, right? It will change 14 points on the scoreboard potentially. So anyway, tell me what Texas is not prepared for going against Washington from our schedule.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a little obvious, but I do want to talk about it in some nuance, which is I think they haven't had a quarterback and a passing game that can execute, particularly in the sort of underneath passing game, like this offense can. So, you know, I think one of the things that makes the Washington offense so difficult is that when you make them one-dimensional, they're not one-dimensional, which is like, even if you can take away the run game, they still are perfectly capable and comfortable in generating consistent yards against your underneath coverage and then using that to sucker you into bad leverage and then beating you deep. And so I think, you know, Texas has played several backup quarterbacks. Texas has played a number of teams that have a dangerous athlete at wide receiver, or maybe two, but certainly not a host of dangerous receivers. And I think that challenge of taking away the offense's engine in terms of consistent yards and how well they operate underneath, in addition to being threatened deep, I don't think Texas has really dealt with that.
Yeah, the thing that strikes me, that's really well said. The thing that strikes me about Washington is that they can execute the offense and just steal execution yards. Good route, good read, good throw. Boom, boom, boom. And it just keeps happening. Like, and at the same time, they can do baller stuff. And what I mean by that is wrong call, wrong route, maybe not a great throw, and Roma Dunze gets 37 yards because he bitches your defensive back, who's in perfect coverage up until the last second when they panic and Odunze just takes the ball from him. Or Jalen McMillan catches the ball and he's now healthy from the slot, faces up on a guy who's right there, eludes him, and suddenly what should have been third and nine is third and one. And you're scratching your head, like, how did he, like, we had the right call there. Like, what just happened? So to me, that's really dangerous. You know, Texas has played these teams with, like, great athletes, and they just kind of go play ball. And then Texas has played a lot of Big 12 high execution teams, right? Mm-hmm. Very rarely in football or college football do you see both. I mean, and I think that's an interesting aspect to Washington. And what we just need to prepare ourselves for is there's going to be times when they drop back to pass, and we're going to have perfect coverage, and we're going to have some pressure, and they're still going to hit a back shoulder throw to freaking Jalen Polk or Rome Odunze for 22 yards, and Michael Taft was in perfect coverage. And everyone's going to say, Michael Taft has to make a play there. It's like, that's not defensible. The Baltimore Ravens couldn't stop that play. And the point is, if they can do that for four quarters, we lose. Sorry. But very few teams can do that for four quarters. So, and Washington hasn't ever done that for four quarters in a game. I've seen them do it for a quarter, though. And I've seen them do it for a quarter and a half, which is, you know, the scary part for that team in general.
Yeah, just to tie this to what we were talking about with Penix earlier, I think Penix as a rhythm thrower, meaning he makes the pre-snap read, he and the wide receivers are on a page, he throws to a spot.
Yep.
And by the way, he's very rarely even making a read on that. A lot of it is trust-based, which is the receivers are running routes to position the defender that is on them and get them into bad leverage for the route they're running. And then the ball is just there. There might not even be a lot of, you know, separation. It's just that the ball is to the right side of the leverage where only mm-hmm. the receiver can catch it. So those rhythm throws, they're tough to take away. They're frustrating, I think, for a defense, because it's sort of like you feel like you're playing correctly and you're still giving up gains. My thing is, I think we can't just concede easy passes, and we can't give up busts deep.
Yep.
And so if Penix is making, he also makes rhythm throws, by the way, that are vertical. Like, they'll identify a matchup and then he'll just launch it and go for the one-on-one matchup. And he's really good at placing those balls too. A lot of times to like outside shoulder, where again, only the receiver can make the ball. I can live if we give some of those up. That's not a big deal. But if we're giving up, if we're kind of being pulled back and forth by their passing game between trying to defend the underneath and then getting exposed deep, I think we're in trouble.
Yeah, so I think formationally, we're playing two safeties deep most of this game. The question is dispositionally what we're doing. So what I mean is, you could play two safeties deep, but you could be circa 2000 Bob Stoops cover two, and those two safeties at the snap of the ball are flying downhill like maniacs, right? So you could say, well, they're in cover two. We can't run certain routes. They're not in cover two. They're kind of almost in cover zero if you can get your play action off, right? Texas, similar. You could play different kinds of cover two. You could play, I'm going to stand here flat-footed, and I ain't moving till I see a read from the quarterback, and I'm going to go make a play on the ball. Or you could play cover two, like, hey, play action, or they're handing the ball off. I got to go fill my lane, and then everything in between. So I think there's going to be an interesting battle between Texas alignment and our disposition. And we do have some personnel who, by the way, can disrupt some of the easy candy Washington's used to. Jahde Barron, he's a maniac, and he's now healthy again. And I've never seen a 185-pound guy be more disruptive at the line of scrimmage to screen games, to, you know, little pop passes, to all that sort of stuff. That's a big deal, you know. So we need to let him loose, certainly on their slot. And then, you know, we've got physical DBs. They're not always great with the ball in the air. We've seen them bust. We've seen, you know, obviously not having Williams in the first half with the targeting is not ideal, but you know, I think these guys are capable, but I think there's something we can talk about, which might be an interesting wild card for this game, where we can give those guys some reinforcements and play to our strengths up front. But we're going to have to cover that in our next podcast, because I think we've gone almost over an hour, amazingly, covering only two major questions, which tells you something about our potential to blather on here, folks. Scott, are there any parting shots or thoughts you want before we continue with the next series of thoughts and questions?
No, I think it's a good stopping point. Maybe we have a little bit of a feel for like some of the big challenges that both of these teams present to each other. And I am interested to sort of transition to thinking about, well, how do we solve some of these problems?
Absolutely. And look, our goal, whether we achieve it or not, is to go a little deeper than the talking head, simplistic. The key to this game, the Washington passing game against the Texas defensive backs, right? And it's like, it's actually a little deeper than that. You know, this is an entire football game. And by the way, all your little matchups fall apart if Texas blocks a punt and Xavier Worthy brings back one for 70, right? You know, that's also part of football. That people don't talk about in these games. So that's our goal. That's our best ambition. If you enjoyed it, please make sure you rate, subscribe, and review. I do a terrible job of asking you guys to do that. When I have, though, literally 30 to 50 of you immediately go do it, which I really, really appreciate. So thanks for being such awesome listeners. So if you haven't done it, if you're listening on Spotify, if you're listening on Apple, just go right now, rate it and review it. Give us 5 stars, and hopefully that content will get spread to other Longhorn fans or college football fans that you think would benefit. And then finally, I get email notifications from Amazon whenever there's a foreign or overseas purchase of Thinking Texas Football. And I got one the other day. Someone bought it in Australia. And I was like, that's odd. You know, after October or after September, no one buys the preview anymore, right? It's got the lifespan of a mayfly. And so I logged into my account and I noticed that I'd actually sold quite a few in the month of December. And I was like, that's odd. And I was like, no, it's not odd. What's happening is Texas is having a special season and a bunch of people are buying the preview as a way to commemorate it. So for those of you who are doing it, thank you very much. For those of you who haven't done it, it's kind of a cool idea. And spoiler alert, I picked Texas to win the Big 12. And I picked Texas to go 8-1 in conference play. So what do you know? Every now and then a squirrel does find a nut, Scott. So if y'all think it would be a great New Year's gift or a wonderful way to commemorate a breakout season, frankly, what I think is the turning point for this program going forward, probably for the next 10 to 20 years, go buy it. I think you'll be glad looking back 20 years from now that you have it. That you gave it to your kid, that you gave it to your grandson sometime down the road. Enough of the hard sell on that. For Scott Gerlach, I am Paul Wadlington saying thank you, mahalo, and we'll be back for part 2.